episode 212 of The Cricket Her Weekly. We are so excited, aren't we, Sid?
Oh, absolutely. It's going to be the biggest week ever. Taylor Swift's new album is being released on Friday, and I just can't wait.
That
was what you were talking about.
No, that wasn't actually what I was talking about. I was talking about the start of the domestic women's cricket season on Saturday.
Yeah, that as well. Yeah.
So you're equally excited for that?
Equally excited,
presumably.
Yes.
Good. Thanks for that. So we're going to do a little bit of a preview of the season. First thing to say is that I think it is going to be a bit of a strange season. In the same way that 2019 was a bit of a strange season, because we all knew as it kicked off that it was going to be the last season that looked like that. And that's exactly what we're going into with this season. We don't quite know what's coming. I mean, in a way we do. We know that there's going to be 8 county teams, so the regions won't exist. But we don't know whether, for example, Southern Vipers as a name will exist next season. We don't know whether the Charlotte Edwards Cup or the Rachel Hayhoe Flint Trophy will still be contested for, or whether they will be renamed to kind of bring them in line with the men's competitions and the men's sponsors. And so it's all a bit weird, isn't it, Sid?
Yeah, it is. I mean, they have released more information this time. It's kind of interesting to think about it from the players' perspective, because when we look back on that last time these reorgs happened, one of the players' big complaints is that they didn't know what was happening. And, you know, this year, well, they've got a bit more information, but on an individual player level, actually, you still don't know what's happening.
No.
So it's going to be kind of challenging for the players because, you know, some top players are still going into this season going, well, you know, this season I'm playing for this team, but I don't know where I'm going to be next season.
Yeah.
Especially the players that think that there's a risk that their team might move somewhere else.
Yes,
so, for,
exactly.
for example, if you were a South East Stars player and you go, well, there's a chance that the club could move to Kent, and, you know, there's a chance that I won't get picked up under those circumstances. So, you know, and we could see, for instance, in a situation where somebody starts a game this season playing for one team against the team that they'll find out during the game they're going to be playing for next year.
Because we should say that we know that players will be negotiating contracts for the new teams during this season.
Yeah, so by October,
everyone will know where they're playing. But what that means is that the next 3 months are a kind of sea of uncertainty.
Yeah, and you'll start the game playing for South East Stars or whatever. You could have a word with the opposition coach at lunchtime where he gives you a nod and a wink.
Or she.
And, you know, you're going to be playing for someone else next year. You're playing for Hampshire or Kent.
Very weird for the players and potentially quite a bit of upheaval. It's all a bit strange, isn't it, Sid?
But what about the actual? Overseas signings have been something that a lot of teams have trumpeted their overseas signings, haven't they, Raf? So who are the big overseas signings for you? Who have you got your eye on?
Well, first thing to say is that more overseas signings than any previous season. So it feels like we're in the last year of regional cricket and the regions have finally got their acts together and gone, oh, yeah, we actually do need to think about having our one overseas or two overseas in the case of the Thunder. But you are only allowed to field one overseas, aren't you?
Yeah.
I would say that for me, the most interesting signing is Erin Burns for the Northern Diamonds.
Okay.
And reason being that last season she was playing for the Central Sparks. And she's sort of been pinched by the Diamonds. So I don't have any inside info. I would love to know what's gone on there. What's the dynamic? Why has she decided to move? Was there some kind of battle for her? Was she able to negotiate more money, for example, at the Diamonds? Not sure, but she was a really, really valuable player for the Sparks last season. And I think they're going to miss her and that the Diamonds have picked up a bit of a diamond, you might say. Sid, what about you?
Well, for me, I mean, the huge one is Amanda Jade Wellington. I think that she's kind of the closest to being a sort of actual superstar.
Yeah.
I know that she's not a regular player for Australia, but she is a player that's played in the big overseas league. She's a big name. Everyone knows who she
is.
Most of the people that follow the men's game will also know who she is, whereas they probably don't know who, for instance, Charlie Nott is. And the key as well that what Western Storm have done is they've picked her up for the entire season. I think that does make a big difference. If you can get an overseas player, like Nadine de Klerk playing most of the season last year for Blades, made a big difference. She was able to really have that long-term impact because, you know, it does make a difference. If you just come in somewhere for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks, yeah, of course, you know, if it's your job, you'll go in there and you'll do your absolute best. But if you're there for 3 or 4 months,
yeah,
then that's when you can, you know, really, you know, put in the performances and kind of build up your, you know, your knowledge of your teammates and kind of make yourself count. And I think that Amanda Jade Wellington is the perfect person to do that. I think she'll have a really good season, and she'll be a really positive signing for Western Storm, who, you know, haven't been the best side over regionals.
Yeah, you would say have sort of punched below their weight, really, given how successful they were in the previous competition, the Kia Super League. It's been a bit of a difficult few years for the Storm, but what an exciting signing.
An impact signing, really. Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. Charlie Knott for the Vipers, that's going to potentially make a big difference.
Well, another great signing. Well, we've talked before about the Vipers' big bowling signing, which is a domestic signing. Not too many domestic moves this year, but of course the Vipers have brought in Freya Davis as a kind of top bowler, you know, recent England player. And Charlie Knott, Charlie Knott actually bowls a bit. She bowled a fair amount of balls in WBBL, and with a decent degree of control there. Her numbers didn't quite reflect that, I don't think. But, you know, her batting numbers were actually really good in WBBL. And she's not a player that's kind of been fast-tracked into the Australia team. You know, she's not the Phoebe Litchfield. But, okay, here's a good stat. But she scored nearly 300 runs in WBBL. Now, the biggest boundary hitter in WBBL, who do you think it is, Raf? I'll give you one guess.
I'm going to say Grace Harris.
It's Grace Harris. Of course it is. Grace Harris hits a boundary every 4 balls, including the last WBL. Charlie Knott hit a boundary every 5 balls. So that's only, you know, it's quite close on the heels. And scoring nearly 300 runs, hitting a boundary every 5 balls. She's a serious hitter. So I think that she's going to have a really good impact for the Vipers with the bat. Yeah. And she's going to, you know, give some real impetus to their batting. And you know, potentially seeing her and Freya Kemp batting together, hold on to your hats in the stands.
Hold on to your heads, I think. Or cover your heads. That's great. So Vipers have done that annoying thing that Vipers do year on year, which is basically progress forward with all of the amazing players who won tournaments for them last year and then added to them with some, as you say, two great new signings there. In terms of the England players' availability for regional cricket, we understand that that's likely to be very limited, even more so than we've seen in previous seasons, purely because they've literally just come back from New Zealand. And then the Pakistan series starts in May. Because of the fact that the World Cup is going to be starting in September, we don't know when, actually that means that both at the front and the back end of the season, around the 100, the England players are really quite unlikely to have very much availability for regional cricket.
Yeah, so all of the regions are basically going to have to kind of assume that they're not going to have any England players.
Yeah.
I think you build your team and you build your squad on that assumption. So just to look at the example of Vipers, you basically go, okay, we're probably not going to have Lauren Bell. If we have Lauren Bell for any games at all, it's a bonus.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a chance to, you know, let Mary Taylor have a bit of a rest. But, you know, we're basically going to go into this season assuming that, you know, Mary Taylor is a key part of our team, and she's going to play almost all our games in that opening bowler role, for example.
And
the same across all the other
regions. Genius that Lottie's signed Freya Davies, who can equally open the bowling on the occasions when Lauren Bell's availability is more limited. So I think, and also just thinking about what Heather Knight said in the post-tour press conference after the New Zealand tour, she sort of said, well, it's going to be done on a case-by-case basis, but I think we're thinking that on most case bases, if that's a term, it's going to be limited availability. I'm really interested to see how Sunrisers get on this season, actually.
That little run they went on at the end of the last season after they appointed Grace Scrivens as captain.
Three back-to-back wins. So Grace Scrivens' record as Sunrisers captain currently stands at 100%. Weren't we doing it every time she won a game? We were just doing a tweet last season, weren't we? So we'll be hoping to add to those tweets this time around. So that's going to be really interesting, and to see what impact actually captaining in those England A games has had on Grace Scrivens as a player.
Yeah, I mean, the England A games weren't easy games, but you know, you take the tough games as well, and you know, it's going to be a big start to the season in terms of her career. I think that she kind of really needs people to stand up, but she'll get those players fighting for her. So you know, let's see how they get on. Thunder is going to be really interesting this season, I think, because Thunder have definitely, you feel that they've really underperformed in the past four or five seasons.
Based on the quality of players that they have and the kind of resources that they have.
With those players and those resources, they ought to have been doing better than they're doing. They have had a big turnover in the coaching staff.
Yeah.
So Paul Shaw has moved on and he's been replaced by Chris Reid. So, you know, it will be a case of him walking in and trying to read the room.
Oh, dear.
Read the room.
That's really bad.
No, seriously.
Sid, read the room. Nobody's laughing.
They are. They're all there laughing. I know they are. No, but he's got a real opportunity there because he is coming into a side that have underperformed, and that's, you know, the ideal situation to be in as a coach.
That's true.
Because you've got the players, you just have to kind of fiddle with their mindset. It's a position, you know, that Mark Robinson kind of thing, where you can come in and you can take existing players that are good players but not performing and turn them into good players that perform, and then, you know, it'll be Thunder's season.
It strikes me that actually some of the coaches this season are going to be under pressure as well, because of course we have no idea what the counties will be thinking in terms of coaching staff for their new teams. They're obviously all
going to
need
of course, effectively,
coaching,
they're going to have to run and they're going to have to reapply
well,
for their own jobs.
In a way, they're auditioning for their own job by how they perform this season. And that doesn't just apply to Chris Reid, that applies to all of the regional coaches. I mean, goodness me, nobody's going to be sacking Charlotte Edwards. They'd have to be absolutely mad. But some of the other coaches are going to come under real pressure.
Well, the interesting thing as well, I mean, I hadn't thought of this before, Raph, but of course, some of the other regions will be going, we want Charlotte Edwards. Will someone try and poach Charlotte Edwards?
I hadn't thought of that either. That's exciting.
If you're Surrey and you've got a decent budget, you'll go, what's the way to ensure that our women's team really come through in the season after next?
Yeah.
And the way to do that will be to poach Charlotte Edwards. You know, offer her enough money and she might make that move.
I think it would be a smart move on behalf of the counties. The only thing mitigating against it is that Lottie herself is an extremely loyal person. And I don't think that she would make that move lightly. We're assuming here that that Hampshire win the Tier 1 bid, which of course we do not know, but we understand that the counties will be informed this week at some point. We don't know when or even whether there will be a public announcement. There flipping well should be, because otherwise it's going to leak out.
You've got to imagine there will be, because it will leak out otherwise.
But anyway, so that was just an assumption on my part that she'll have the opportunity to stay at Hampshire, but of course she might not. If Sussex win, then that's going to be a much less attractive prospect for her, because of partly because she spent most of her career playing for Kent, and those two counties look kind of historically.
I'm sure that's all water under the bridge, Sid.
Anyway, the big question, Sid, that obviously we all want to know the answer to from you is, can Vipers do the double again?
I think that, you know, if I was putting money on it, I'd say yes.
Okay.
But don't gamble, kids. But if you do...
You are a bit biased, though, aren't you? You are a little bit biased.
I am a little bit biased, but I think that, you know, that they're a strong side that have got stronger, and, you know, I think that you'd be a fool to bet against them.
Okay, fair enough. Right, in other news this week, sort of related, the PCA, so that's our English Professional Cricketers Association...
The sort of players' union.
Yeah, have completed their pre-season meetings, and they have done a press release this week. So basically they go round to all of the regions and the counties for the men, and they sit down with the players and they have a chat to them, essentially. There's been some really interesting things that have kind of come out of this, particularly in relation to women's cricket, aren't there, Sid?
Yeah, there are. And I think that the key thing for me is that in the press release, they talked about, you know, a number of different issues, like, you know, salaries, for example. There's two ways of looking at salaries, for example. The salaries for the highest paid players, are they the same as the men? And also the minimum wage, the salaries at the other end, are the minimum wage the same? And these are both issues that have come up. But for me, the most interesting one is about access to facilities. Because they say in this press release... And that, if it says in the press release, you can guarantee that it was a big theme of what players were talking about. Yeah. Access to facilities is the big thing. It's the thing that all of the players say is not good enough.
Yeah.
Across, and it says quite explicitly, across all of the regions.
Yeah.
Didn't say all of the regions except this one. All of the regions, access to facilities.
Yeah.
And that's things like access to the nets, access to the gym. And this fascinates me because, you know, with this regional system is going into its fifth year now. They had a lot of time to sort out this stuff, and access to facilities in particular is easy to fix if you really want to. If you're in charge of the club and you want to make sure that there are equal access to facilities, you just say there are equal access to facilities. And you accept that you might inconvenience the men. And it might be that your men's captain desperately always wants to train on Thursday and Friday mornings in the gym, and you have to go to him, "Well, I'm afraid, men's captain, you need to not be there. You can go on Thursday, but on Friday, that's the women's access to the gym." It's easy to fix this stuff. And they haven't done it, right?
No, they haven't done it. But that's one of the problems with the regional system, isn't it? Is that actually what seems to be one of the themes of this conversation is that the regional teams are sort of outside of the counties, and therefore they don't have that, that, you know, they can't go to a county A and say, you know, there's a problem with access to facilities, because county A will sort of go, "Oh, well, actually, maybe you should go and speak to county B about that, or county C." So the regional structure sitting outside of the men's county structure has perhaps contributed to that problem. On the other hand, equally, what concerns me is that counties bidding for these tier one contracts will have had to explicitly say in their bids, well, the women will get this access, and perhaps the women will get access to the gym on these days at these times, and the men will get it on these days at these times, and sort of write that kind of equal access into their bids. But who's going to enforce that when it actually happens? Who's going to, you know, if you've got Bob Basher in the gym when it's meant to be the turn of the women's team, do the women's team then have to come in and have a really uncomfortable conversation and kick him out? Are the county staff who are around going to actually be there to enforce that? Or is it going to be a case of, well, we wrote this in theory because it looks nice, but in practice, the conditions that these women's players are operating under won't actually change? That does concern me a bit, because the people who are operating on the ground to enforce this equal access, which we hope will get better under the new system, are people who have been kind of, you know, worked in a system, a county system, which has systematically excluded women. And, you know, 5 years ago when we had women's county cricket, it was nowhere, it was nothing. It's the same people, it's the same personnel who are working within it. How do we know that that culture and that attitude to women's county teams will have changed at all? Well, we don't.
Yeah, and it's the kind of big issue surrounding the whole thing is like, the you know, again, with the PCA are raising these issues, but, you know, these issues have been around for a long time. And who's been representing the female players for the last 5 years?
Yeah.
You know, shouldn't the PCA have actually done something to address these issues?
That's, I find that infuriating as well, because the PCA are sat there going, "Oh, this is a big problem." And it's like, well, what have you done?
Who was the players union for all this?
You know, you look back in 2018, I had a look back at when they had these new women domestic professionals coming in. I think it was initially 100. And that was the same time that they introduced the minimum wage. The minimum wage, which has never applied to women's cricket. And the PCA are now coming out and going, "Oh, yeah, of course, we need to have an equitable minimum wage or an equal minimum wage." Well, yeah, you were the ones who set a minimum wage and then almost pretended that it applied to women's cricket. Or it's either that, or you just ignored the existence of women's cricket because you had this 27,500, and then you were quite happy for the ECB
minimum
to introduce
wage, but not like that.
You were quite happy for the ECB to introduce new professional domestic contracts for the women, which were set way below that. So they have been doing a really terrible job at representing the women. And again, it's the same personnel in the PCA who have done nothing for women's cricket, who are now coming out and going, "Oh yeah, it's an absolute travesty that they haven't got the same amount of money." Now, what I think's happened here is that the ISEC, the Independent Commission, has given the PCA an imperative to do something about this. Because as we've said many times on this podcast, before, like a year ago, nobody was talking about equal pay seriously. I was trying to say it was a really important thing. But outside of our vodcast,
and everyone else thought it was nonsense.
Yeah, and that clearly, based on actions, included the PCA. Yeah. Now the ISEC have come along and gone, "Oh, actually, it's really important that you have a an equal minimum wage for men and women, whether that be at domestic or international level." And the PCA have gone, "Oh, yeah, we probably should do something about that." So that's
a bit
frustrating.
That's a positive impact of the ISEC.
It is absolutely positive.
Like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And this is positive. And we do know that the PCA and the ECB have verbally agreed on a new minimum squad size of 15 for these new tier one teams. So we're going to have teams which have 15 fully professional contracts, and they are going to equalise that minimum wage for men's and women's cricketers, and that's going to be written into the new county policy.
Which is actually going to be quite a decent pay rise for the people at the very bottom of the scale at the moment that are just kind of struggling to get by. So that's a positive as well. So, you know, and let's make sure we hold their feet to the fire on that and make sure that, you know, we're asking those questions in a year's time.
Yeah, absolutely. And finally, Sid, this week, we've watched not one, but two women's cricket documentaries. One of them was sort of had a bit of women's cricket in, but you know, you wait ages for a cricket documentary and then two come along at once.
Both available on YouTube for you guys to watch, so check them out.
So the first one is Cricket Actually, which has been made by the ECB, and it's a sort of conglomeration of various stories, isn't it?
It is. It's not specifically about the women's game at all, but it's definitely worth your while watching. It's a very classic documentary, and I really loved it, and I've really thought an awful lot about it. In some ways, it's not really a documentary about cricket, actually, I think, in retrospect. Mm. It's a documentary about the state of this country, about the state of England, and about, you know, the kind of prevalence of an awful lot of huge pockets of kind of what you might call inequality and poverty in this country. People often say that England is basically a poor country with London attached. You know, rich London, poor the rest of the country. And this is really a documentary about those kind of poorer areas of the country and taking cricket as a sort of theme to kind of look at some people within those poor areas generally. So I really loved it, and I think you should definitely watch that. The other documentary, which I suspect more of our followers have already sought out, and in fact, a couple of people I think that might be watching this were in it. Is the Lancashire documentary,
Bring the Thunder. Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed this. It's obviously great to see a documentary kind of focusing on one of the women's regional teams, and you do get a little bit of more of an idea about some of these players, some of the kind of big characters in the dressing room, their story. It's beautifully kind of shot and produced, although it is very interesting that the quality of the footage emanating from Lancashire of women's regional cricket is noticeably much better than the quality of the other streams when you put them side by side.
Puts everyone else to shame. The quality of what they're producing is just their match day footage. It's awesome.
I did think that it was a bit funny the way that it very much kind of focused on Thunder's path to the semi-final of the Charlotte Edwards Cup, and then totally glossed over the fact that they lost quite badly to Vipers in the semi-final. It was obviously predicated on the idea that they might go on and win this trophy, and then they had to kind of go, oh, but you know, we'll come back stronger next year at the end. So that was interesting. And I guess when you are producing one of these documentaries and you're doing it internally about your own team, it's inevitably going to be very focused on the positives, and you're not going to get the criticism, and you're not going to get the kind of, you know, maybe there were, I can't imagine that Thunder are such a unified team that there are never dressing room spats, or that there's never, you know, something else going on. Is there, you know, that Paul Shaw never yells at them, or, you know, like, why?
I don't think Paul Shaw ever yells at anybody.
But it just felt, it's very kind of, everything's rosy and everything's lovely at the Thunder. And as we've already just talked about the PCA stuff, clearly everything isn't totally perfect, even for the Thunder players.
We go back to what it said in that PCA thing, is that every single region has a problem with access to facilities. And yet in this documentary, you've got Kate Cross sitting there going, we've got total equal access
with
them. Everything's great. Well, that's not what the Thunder players told the PCA about.
We're getting two slightly different stories here, but you know, you can't necessarily expect them to be taking in all those nuances. You really need an independent production company to come in, a totally independent one, in order to do that. But you know, it's definitely well worth a watch, and it is a great watch. It's very kind of easy on the eye in terms of, like, it's very beautifully put together. So would definitely recommend.
Okay.
Right, we'll wrap up there, Sid. Next week when we're recording, the season will have started. Obviously Taylor Swift's album will be out as well, if anyone has any interest in that. So we will see you in a week's time. Bye-bye.
Bye.